Before I begin or continue Chapter 3, I would like to point out that reading a book aloud, such as Mein Kampf, is the surest way to become an Anonphily. I say this with certainty, because after only 3 days, I find that I'm a little hoarse. With that horrible pun out of the way, let us continue Chapter 3. This is how it ends with every question. Things are always settled by a majority of ignoramuses and incompetents, since the membership of this institution never truly changes. The problems presented extend to almost every field of public life, and would require a constant change of parliamentary leaders to judge and vote on them. After all, it is impossible to let the same people deal with matters of transportation and with a question of important foreign policy. Otherwise, they would all have to be geniuses in every area, and this does not happen once in centuries. Even worse, they are not brains at all, but only narrow, conceited, and arrogant amateurs with intellectual pretenders of the worst sort. In fact, that is the reason for the incomprehensible carelessness these ruling classes display when they make decisions on matters that even the greatest minds would find stressful. Measures of vital importance for the whole state, actually, the fate of the people and the entire race, are treated as if they are a game of sheep shed or tarot, which would be a more suitable pursuit for such people. Schafkopf or sheep's head is a card game common in Bavaria. Tarot is fortune-telling by cards, and parentheses. Of course, it would be unfair to say every deputy in Parliament has no sense of responsibility. That is not the case at all. But by forcing the individual member to make up his mind on questions which are not in the realm of his talents, this system gradually corrupts the character of every member. Nobody is going to have the courage to say, "Gentlemen, I do not think we know anything about this matter. I personally, at any rate, certainly do not." It would not make any difference if he did state his objection, because that kind of frankness would not be understood in this crowd of people, and people would not let such an honest ass spoil everyone else's game. Anyone who knows human nature will understand that in such a situation, nobody likes to be the dunce, and in certain circles, honesty is a synonym for stupidity. So, a representative who begins by being honorable is forced down the crowded path of lies and cheating. He believes that an individual withdrawing from a decision would not make any difference in the eventual outcome of the group decision, and this kills every honest impulse that a person may feel. He will end up telling himself that he personally is far from the worst, and that by joining in, he might prevent worse things from happening. Some may object by saying, even though the individual deputy may not have any special understanding of a particular matter, his belief is based on the direction given by the party, by his politics. The party has its separate committees, and he feels they are more than sufficiently informed by experts. At first glance, this seems to be true. But then comes the question. Why choose 500 when just a few of them possess the necessary wisdom needed to adopt a policy in important matters? Yes, there is the true difficulty in the whole system. The basis of our present democratic parliament is not to form an assembly of wise men, but instead to put together a herd of nobodies who are dependent on the intellect of everyone around them. They become easier to lead in a certain direction as their abilities decrease. This is the only way party politics can be carried on. This is the only way it is possible for the puppeteer to remain hidden in the background without ever being personally held accountable for what he does. Then, every decision, no matter how harmful to the nation, is blamed on a whole party, and not just one mischievous culprit pulling the strings. All responsibility disappears, because responsibility can only exist if an individual makes a decision and not an association of parliamentary windbags. Only an evil creature of the night, fearful of daylight, could approve of this institution, while every honest man who accepts personal responsibility for his own actions must find it disgusting. Consequently, this kind of democracy has become the tool of that race whose real purpose forces it to hide its actions from sunlight where others might see now and forever. only the Jew can praise an institution as dirty and deceptive as himself. On the other side, we have the true Germanic democracy consisting of a free election. This leader is bound to assume full responsibility for everything he does. In this format, there is no roll call of a majority on individual questions, but only the rule of an individual who has to support his decisions with his property and his life. To anyone who objects by saying no one would be willing to devote himself to such a risky responsibility under those conditions, there is but one answer. Thank God. It is the very purpose of a Germanic democracy to keep every unworthy political climber who might by chance fall into the office from gaining any power in the government of his fellow man through the back door. The very magnitude of this responsibility is meant to scare off weaklings and incompetents. If such a fellow should try to sneak in any way, it is easier to find and harshly punish him. Get away, you coward! Step away! You are stinking up the stairway! The front steps to the pantheon of history are not for cowards, but for heroes! I arrived at this opinion after watching the Vienna Parliament for 2 years. Then I stopped going. The parliamentary government was largely responsible for the ever-increasing weakness of the old Habsburg state during the previous few years. The more its work shattered German supremacy, the more a system of playing one nationality against another gained ground. In the parliament building itself, this was always at the expense of the Germans, and eventually at the expense of the empire. By the turn of the century, it had to have been obvious to any fool that the central force of the monarchy could no longer overcome the individual country's attempts to break loose. On the contrary, the more terrible the methods became that were used by the state for self-preservation, the more universally the state was hated. In Hungary and in the individual Slavic provinces, the people did not identify themselves with the monarchy, so they did not feel its weakness was shameful to them. Instead, they were rather pleased at the signs of senility because they preferred the monarchy's death to its recovery. The complete collapse of Parliament was only prevented by giving in to humiliating concessions that consisted of inappropriate demands. Of course, the Germans had to foot the bill. In Austria, defense of the states depended on paying off the various nationalities against one another. But the general line of development still bore down the Germans. When the imperial succession gave Archduke Francis Ferdinand more influence, the increase of Czech authority really began to accelerate with his support from above. This future rule of the dual monarchy used every means possible to promote and encourage the removal of the German element, or at least to cover it up. Through the civil servants, purely German towns were slowly but surely pushed into the danger zone of mixed language. In Lower Austria, this policy progressed even quicker, and many Czechs already considered Vienna their greatest city. The family of the new Habsburg monarchy spoke only Czech. The Archduke's lower-class wife, a former Czech countess, belonged to a group who held their fear of Germans as a tradition. His primary purpose was gradually to set up a Slavic state in Central Europe, built on a strong Catholic foundation as a defense against Orthodox Russia. The Habsburgs commonly made religion the servant of their political idea, and this had a disastrous effect on the Germans. The results were more than sad in several respects. Neither the House of Habsburg nor the Catholic Church received the expected reward. The Habsburgs lost their throne, and Rome lost a great state. By putting religious elements to work for political purposes, the crown awakened a spirit that it had not dreamed was possible. When they attempted to completely exterminate German culture in the old monarchy, the response was a pan-German movement in Austria. This movement wanted to unify all German language speakers and German ethnic people into a single German state. By the 1880s, the Manchester Liberalism, a political, economic, and social movement in the 19th century originating in Manchester, England, which challenged the existing economic system, which was fundamentally Jewish, had reached the peak of influence in the dual monarchy. Like everything in old Austria, the reaction against it was primarily founded on nationalistic and not social considerations. Self-preservation forced German elements to defend themselves with the greatest force. Economic considerations slowly gained an important influence, but only as an afterthought. Two parties emerged from the general political turmoil. One had a nationalistic tendency, and the other more social, and both were extremely interesting and instructive for the future. After the crushing conclusion of the War of 1866, also called the 7 Weeks' War between Austria and Prussia, with Germans on both sides, it gave Prussia control over most smaller German states, the House of Habsburg considered retaliation on the battlefield. The death of Emperor Maximilian of Mexico prevented a closer alliance with France. Emperor Maximilian I of Mexico was Austrian-born and part of the Habsburg-Lorraine royal house. He was installed with the help of the French in 1864 as a monarch of Mexico, but was overthrown and executed in 1867. His unfortunate expedition was blamed on Napoleon III. And his desertion by the French soldiers aroused universal anger. But even then, Habsburgs were lying in wait. In the War of 1870-71, the Franco-Prussian War, the Prussian victory restored the German Empire, had not turned out to be such a triumphant march. The Vienna court would probably still have ventured the bloody game of revenge for Sadowa, the German name for Sadova, a village in the Czech Republic, when the first remarkable and unbelievable but true tales of heroism came from the battlefield, the so-called wisest of all monarchs realized the timing for revenge was inappropriate and decided tried to make the best of a bad situation by accepting it with grace. The heroic struggle of those years produced an even greater miracle. The Habsburgs showed new attitudes, but it never meant there was a change of heart, just pressure from the current situation. The German people in the old Eastern territories were carried away by Germany's joyful intoxication in victory, and were deeply touched by the resurrection of their father's dream, which became a reality. Make no mistake, even in the Czech city of Königgrätz, the German-spirited Austrians saw the tragic but inevitable need for the resurrection of the empire, an empire which could not be contaminated with the stench of the old German Confederation. Königgrätz is a reference to the Battle of Königgrätz, where Prussia defeated Austria, and this became the first step in the formation of the German Empire. Above all, he learned by bitter personal experience that the House of Habsburg had at last completed its historic mission, and that the new empire must only choose the Kaiser as a man whose heroic spirit made him worthy of the title Crown of the Rhine. The spirit of fate, which bestowed this honor upon the descendant of a house that in the distant past had given the nation a shining symbol of national praise in Frederick the Great, a symbol to last forever, that fate deserves great praise. After this great war, the House of Habsburg began to slowly and with desperate determination exterminate the dangerous German element in the dual monarchy. Without any doubt, this was the purpose of the policy which eliminated the German element in favor of Slavs. At that moment, the resistance of these people, who were marked for total destruction, flamed up in a new way to German history. For the first time, patriotic and nationally minded men became rebels. They were rebels against a way of government that would lead to the destruction of their own nationality and not rebel against state or nation. For the first time in recent German history, the customary patriotism for a dynasty was distinguished from the patriotism of national love for the fatherland and its people by open conflict. The Pan-German movement of the German Austria in the 1890s receives credit for clearly and unmistakably realizing that a state has the right to demand respect for its authority only when it is for the protection and the interests of the people, or at least will not cause any harm. State authority cannot exist as an end in itself, or any kind of tyranny would become sacred and untouchable. If the government is driving a nationality to its destruction, the rebellion of every member of that people is not merely a right, but a duty. Whether or not this condition exists is not shown by theoretical stories, but it is shown when force is used against the people and in the success of effort to suppress the nationality. Of course, every governing power claims their responsibility is to uphold the authority of the state, no matter how badly they have abused that authority, even though it has betrayed the interests of a nationality 1,000 times over. In fighting such a power, and in winning freedom or independence, the people's instinct for self-preservation will have to use the same weaponry used by its adversary. That is to say, the battle will be carried on by legal means, as long as the power which is being overthrown also uses legal means. But the insurgents should not hesitate to use illegal means if the oppressor employs them. Never forget that the highest purpose of man's existence is the preservation of his own kind and not the maintenance of a state or government. The question of legality is secondary if the survival of the race is at stake, and they may be pushed aside or destroyed. Even though the methods used by the ruling power are 1,000 times legal, the self-preservation of the oppressed is always the most noble justification for a struggle using any and every weapon. The truth of this statement can be seen by anyone, and this Earth's history shows tremendous examples in the wars of independence against inward or outward enslavement of peoples. The law of humanity is above the law of state. However, if a people are defeated in their struggle for human rights, this means those people are not favored on the scale of fate, and they are not slated to remain on this world. The world will not be possessed by those who are weak-willed. Using Austria as a clear and striking example, it is easy to see how a tyranny can wrap itself up in the so-called legality. The legal power of the state once rested with the anti-German foundation of the parliament, with its non-German majority, and on the equally anti-German ruling house. These elements embody the entire authority of the state. Any attempt to change the German-Austrian people through these groups would have been nonsense. Consequently, our admirers of the legal way as the only permissible one, and those admirers of the state's authority itself, were bound to think that all resistance must be abandoned because it could not be carried on by legal means. This would have inevitably meant a quick end to the German people under the monarchy. The German element was saved from that fate only by the collapse of the state. The theorist, with his thick glasses hanging off his nose, would rather die for his doctrines than for his people. He believes that since men made laws for themselves, men should thereafter exist for the laws. To the credit of the pan-German movement in Austria, and to the horror of all amateur theoreticians in other state worshippers, the pan-German movement swept away this nonsense. While the Habsburgs were trying to close ranks on the German element by whatever means possible, this party struck back and ruthlessly attacked the exalted ruling house itself. The party was the first to dig into the rotten state and open the eyes of hundreds of thousands. The pan-German movement deserves the credit for rescuing the love of the fatherland from the embrace of this sorry dynasty. When it first began, the party had such an extraordinary following that it threatened to become a regular landslide, but its success did not last. By the time I arrived in Vienna, the movement had long since sunk into complete insignificance and was overtaken by the Christian Socialist Party. The whole process of the Pan-German movement's growth and decline, and the Christian Socialist Party's unheard-of rise, was a classical example for study and of great importance to me. When I came to Vienna, my support was totally on the side of the Pan-German movement. The fact that people had the courage to stand up in Parliament and shout "Heil Hohenzollern," hail to the Hohenzollern Prussian dynasty, impressed and delighted me. I felt a happy confidence because they continue to regard themselves as only temporarily separated from the German Empire, and not a moment passed without announcing the fact. It seemed to me that the only remaining road to salvation for our people was to speak out without hesitation on every question concerning the German element and never to compromise. But I could not understand why, after its first magnificent rise, the Pan-German movement would collapse. I understood even less how, in the same period, the Christian Socialist Party, which focused on the privileged class and Catholic priests, had built an enormous power base. It was just then reaching the peak of its fame. While I was attempting to compare the two movements, fate gave me the best instruction I could have hoped for and helped me to understand the reason behind this puzzle. I began my deliberation with the men who must be considered the leaders and founders of the two parties, Jörg von Schörner and Dr. Karl Lueger. Jörg Ritter von Schörner was a well-known nationalist politician in Austria who was anti-Semitic, anti-Slav, anti-Catholic, and pro-Pan-German. He formed the Pan-German Party. In parentheses. In purely human terms, they both tower above any so-called parliamentary figures. In the swamp of general political corruption, they remain pure and above reproach. My personal compassion was on the side of the Pan-German. Schonerer, at first, and gradually extended to the Christian socialist leader, Dr. Karl Lueger. Schonerer's ability to seem to be much better, and he was a more solid thinker on terms of principle. He realized the inevitable end of the Austrian state more clearly and more correctly than anyone else. If the German Empire had listened to his warnings about the Habsburg monarchy, the collapse of Germany's First World War against all of Europe would never have happened. Schonerer could grasp the inner nature of a problem, but was completely unsuccessful as a judge of men. This was Dr. Lueger's strong point. He was a rare judge of human nature, and was careful to never view men as better than they are. Consequently, he primarily dealt with the practical possibilities of life, which Schonerer had little understanding. Everything that the Pan-German Schonerer thought was theoretically true, but he did not have the strength or ability to explain this theory to the masses. He could not express it in a way that the common people, with limited understanding of the issue, could comprehend. Therefore, all his insight was just the wisdom of a seer and could never become a reality. This lack of understanding, when it came to human nature, eventually led to errors in judging the strengths of the movements as a whole and the old traditions. Lastly, Schonerer recognized that these were questions worthy of a world concept, but he did not realize that only the broad masses of people can be the foundations of such almost religious convictions. He did not see how the fighting spirit in the privileged class circles was so badly limited. They had no fighting will because of their economic position. The individual who is afraid may lose too much will. The individual who is afraid may lose too much will and hold himself back and avoid risk. In general, a world concept can only hope for victory if the broad masses, the foundation of the new doctrine, are prepared to fight the necessary battle. His inability to understand the importance of the lower classes gave him an inadequate understanding of the social problem. In this way, Dr. Lueger was Schonerer's opposite. Lueger's thorough knowledge of human nature allowed him to judge the possible forces of men and, at the same time, prevented him from judging the power of existing institutions. This may have been what led him to use the masses as a means to accomplish his goal. He was very well understood that the political fighting strength of the upper level of the privileged class in modern times was small and not sufficient to assure victory for a great new movement. In his political activity, he put the most emphasis on winning over the population whose daily life was threatened. This stimulated rather than paralyzed their fighting spirit. He was also willing to use every instrument of power available to win the favor of powerful existing institutions and derive the greatest possible advantage for his own movement from the old sources of power. He aimed his new party chiefly at the middle class, which was threatened with destruction, and thus assured himself of an almost unshakable following, a following that was ready for great self-sacrifice and full of stubborn, dogged fighting determination. His relation to the Catholic Church was built up with infinite shrewdness, and soon attracted so many of the younger clergy that the old clerical side of the party was forced to either abandon the field of battle or, a wiser choice, to unite with the new party. We would be doing the man a serious injustice if this was the only characteristic we saw in him. Besides being a shrewd tactician, he had the qualities and the genius of a truly great reformer. but all these were limited by the resources he believed were available and also by his own capabilities. This truly outstanding man set himself a completely practical goal. He wanted to capture Vienna. Vienna was the heart of the monarchy. The last remnants of life went out from this city into the sickly and aging body of the rotten empire. The healthier the heart became, the more quickly the body could heal. The idea was right in principle, but could only put in practice for a limited time. That was the weakness of the man. What he achieved as mayor of the city of Vienna is immoral in the best sense of the word, but that did not enable him to save the monarchy. It was too late. His opponent, Schonerer, had seen this more clearly. Dr. Lueger was extremely successful in putting his plans into practice, but this did not give him the result he had hoped for. Schonerer did not have the ability to accomplish what he wanted. What he dreaded most finally happened, and to a frightening degree. The Prime Minister proclaimed civil servants where they were to be required to speak Czech as the official language in Bohemia, which excluded German speakings from applying for government jobs. Soon thereafter, Schonerer lost support due to his strong views and inactive opposition. In parentheses. So neither man reached his ultimate goal. Lueger was too late to save Austria, and Schonerer was too late to preserve the German people from destruction. It is extremely enlightening for us today to study the causes of both parties' failure. It is particularly useful for my friends, because today conditions are not very different from the conditions then. By looking back, we can avoid the same mistakes that brought about the end of one movement and made the other sterile. In my opinion, there were three reasons for the collapse of the Pan-Germany movement in Austria. First, there was only a vague idea of the importance of the social problem, which is particularly bad for a new and revolutionary party. Schonerer and his followers primarily focused on the privileged classes, so the result was bound to be tame and weak. Although its individual members would never expect it, the German privileged class, especially the upper privileged class, is opposed to war to the point of self-surrender in matters of nation or state. In times when the government is functioning well, this inclination is the reason why this class of people is extraordinarily valuable to the state. However, in times when the government is functioning badly, they become absolutely catastrophic. In order to fight a serious battle, the Pan-German movement would have to devote itself to winning over the masses. It did not do this. From the beginning, it was deprived of the basic drive needed to support a wave of momentum and allow it to build. Without this support, it subsided quickly. If you do not realize this principle and carry it out from the beginning, the new party can never recover from this omission later. When a large, moderate, privileged class element is captured, the movement's beliefs will always be directed among their pre-existing ideas, and then any chance of winning strength from the common people is lost. After all, the movement can never progress beyond weak arguing, pale wrangling, and criticism. We can no longer find a religious-like faith and a willingness for self-sacrifice. They are replaced by a process that gradually wears away the rough edges of the questions in dispute, resulting in constructive collaboration, which in this case means acknowledging the existing state of affairs. Ultimately, they wind up in a satisfyingly corrupt peace. That was what happened to the Pan-German government.